Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, a call for a broader definition of anti-Semitism to protect innocent people from hate crimes. We'll spend this hour with New York Times opinion section editor Barry Weiss, who became a bat mitzvah at Pittsburgh's Tree of Life Synagogue years before the shooting last year that killed 11 mostly elderly people. Since then, Weiss's wish to keep Jews safe from violence and intimidation has caused her to look critically at what she sees as anti-Semitism from both the right and the left end of the political spectrum, including antipathy toward the state of Israel. We'll talk with Weiss about why she grew up thinking anti-Semitism in Europe was much worse than it is in the United States and why she's changed her mind about that. Our conversation starts after a short break. Grew up feeling like she was among the luckiest Jews in all of history. She was born in the United States after the middle of the 20th century, a third-generation American without direct ties to the Holocaust, whose parents grew up and met in the same close-knit Pittsburgh Jewish neighborhood where she herself was raised. That sense of relative safety was shattered last October when a gunman killed 11 mostly elderly congregants at the Tree of Life Synagogue, the same place Weiss had become a bat mitzvah in 1997. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Today, Barry Weiss thinks all of us should cast a wider net in trying to identify and eliminate anti-Semitism. She says while it may be obvious among far-right extremists who endorse or carry out acts of terrorism, anti-Semitism may also lie in the hearts of some on the left who fail to recognize and support the seminal role of the State of Israel in providing a safe homeland for the Jewish people. Barry Weiss is a staff writer and editor for the opinion section of the New York Times. Her book is called How to Fight Anti-Semitism. Barry, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
I'm really sorry that there is breaking news, headline news as of yesterday, that will color and anchor this discussion. But this idea that someone carried out an attack on a German synagogue as 2,200 people watched live on the internet is just incredibly disturbing.
Yeah, I mean, I was in synagogue like almost most Jews I know for Yom Kippur yesterday. And during Yom Kippur, there's a special service where we talk about Jewish martyrs throughout history. And growing up, for me, martyr was a word that was consigned to history. I never thought about something that was a modern phenomenon. And of course, you know, that has changed dramatically in the past 2 years. There are 12 people murdered, American Jews, for being Jewish in their synagogues, 11 in Pittsburgh, and then one, Lori Gilbert Kay, in Poway, 6 months later to the day. And then to leave synagogue and to turn on your phone and see that, you know, more have sort of entered the long list of Jewish martyrs. You know, thank God, from everything I've read, this was, you know, a white supremacist neo-Nazi in Germany who had tried to do basically what the killer, Brenton Tarrant, in Christchurch did when he killed 52 Muslims in mosques. And thank God he was stopped by this highly secured door, ended up killing two people outside and I think injuring two others. The 60 or 70 worshipers who were in the synagogue were, thank God, safe. But, you know, I've heard that the Jewish world is tiny. So immediately already today, you know, one of my friends who's a rabbi in Manhattan was friends with people who were in the building and talked about the heroism of the cantor who has sort of barricaded the door and kept people safe. And I'm sure I'll be hearing more details about that. But, you know, it's kind of amazing if you just think about 1 week in Germany that ended with this horrible attack. You know, there was another attempted attack on a synagogue in Berlin in which someone walked in and screamed Allahu Akbar and Israel, excuse my language, with a knife. In another instance, someone threw a rock at a person and an Israeli for speaking Hebrew. So it's sort of coming from various different directions. And if you just look at the news out of Germany this past week, it sort of encapsulates that fact.
You diagnose the problem for Jews in Europe at the moment as a kind of three-headed dragon. Will you talk about the factors that play into that?
Sure. So the first head of the dragon is the anti-Semitism that's coming from the far right. And this is the anti-Semitism expressed by fascists and authoritarians and right-wing populists. This is the anti-Semitism that we American Jews, and I would just say most Jews in general and most people are so familiar with, given the legacy of the Holocaust and Hitler's long shadow. It's the anti-Semitism that announces itself bluntly. It's, you know, was very well expressed, this vile ideology, by the white supremacist in Pittsburgh. It's expressed by Iran. It's the kind of anti-Semitism that says all Jews must die. It's genocidal in its ambitions, and there's sort of no question about it. So while it presents, I would say, for sure, in America right now, the most physically violent threat toward American Jews is coming from white supremacists, there's a lot of clarity about it. There's not a lot of debate over whether or not the Pittsburgh killer or the Poway killer is an anti-Semite. We all hear him and his intentions clearly. So that's the anti-Semitism of the far right. The anti-Semitism of the far left, and I would say that this is the second head of the dragon, is a little bit more confusing. And it's more confusing because it cloaks itself in the language that, frankly, is a siren song to progressive ears and definitely to American Jewish ears. Because the American Jewish experience, right, has been very much, we have seen ourselves as being at home in the Democratic Party, in movements to promote further civil rights, and in progressive movements generally. And so the anti-Semitism of the far left says, we are just trying to promote social justice. We just want to promote anti-racism. We, you know, are supporting a universal brotherhood of man. In a lot of ways, I see a lot of similarities with communism, which sort of announced itself in a similar fashion, but in fact was, as Susan Sontag said, fascism with a human face. And so that's the anti-Semitism that we're seeing on the far left. I think the most prominent example of it, if you just look around the world, is Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, and what sort of happened to the Labour Party under the leadership of Jeremy Corbyn. And then you have, of course, the third head of the dragon, and that's the anti-Semitism that comes out of the Muslim world and out of Islamist movements. And that was something, frankly, that the Jewish world, given the Second Intifada in the early 2000s, was very familiar with. And frankly, if we were scared about a terrorist coming into a synagogue 20 years ago, it would have very much been a jihadi terrorist. That would have been sort of the top line fear. And it's amazing to see how much that has shifted, where now our primary fear is that the person who's going to walk in with a gun is going to be a neo-Nazi white supremacist who is radicalized on a forum like Reddit or 4chan or Gab.com.
You want people to be clear that anti-Semitism is different than racism or xenophobia. Why is that an important distinction to you?
It's not important. I mean, both things are violent, vile, immoral, and despicable and should be condemned. The reason I think it's important to explain how anti-Semitism functions differently ideologically than racism is so we can be better equipped to confront it. What the racist sees in his backward thinking is that the person who is of color is subhuman, is less than him, and therefore deserves less rights or deserves to be killed or any number of horrible things. The anti-Semite fundamentally sees the Jew differently. They can be subhuman, but they can also be something like inhuman or superhuman. Whereas the racist sees themselves as punching down against the person of color, oftentimes the anti-Semite sees themselves as punching up, because in their view of the world, the Jew is kind of the evil puppeteer, the wily person behind the scenes, using his or her proximity to power to control borders, to control the government, to control banks, to control Wall Street, and I can go down the line. And so that's why I think it's important, not because I think that racism presents any less of a threat, but just because it functions quite differently. And I think if you see anti-Semitism only as a form of racism against Jews, you tend to miss a lot.
Why did so much fear and loathing of Jewish power bubble up over centuries when Jews, in fact, had almost no power?
God, that's a great question. You kind of have to go back to the book of Matthew in the New Testament, but really even before that. I mean, one of the things that struck me so much when I was researching for this book is how deep the anti-Semitic conspiracy goes. It has its origins, in fact, in Egypt in 300 BCE, long before Jesus was born. And it grows out of Alexandria, Egypt, in a time where Alexandria was the biggest Jewish community in the world. And the original anti-Semitic conspiracy theory was reacting to the Jewish story of the Exodus. And the reason that the story of the Exodus was such a threat to the surrounding society at the time was that it called a bluff, basically, on all of the things that were sacred to the surrounding Egyptian culture, to the dominant culture. Whereas the Egyptian story, you know, whereas in the dominant Egyptian culture, slavery was okay. Worshipping idols was not only acceptable, was normative. The Jewish story, the Israelite story at the time, said that slavery was wrong. It said that worshipping little clay vessels was not real and that there was only one God. And so the original anti-Semitic conspiracy was basically a revisionist story of the Exodus. And the reason I think it's so important and interesting to look back to that is the Jews, really from the advent of Judaism, were challenging the dominant culture that they were a part of. They were perpendicular to it. And so if you want to understand why, and as I write in this book and why I'll tell your listeners, and I really believe this, that liberal democracies like America have been uniquely good for Jews and uniquely protective of them, is because Jews thrive in places where freedom and liberty are protected. And that is because we represent freedom and liberty by our very existence. The freedom to think and worship differently are sort of encoded in our experience throughout, you know, the past 2,000 years. And so I can go down the line and tell you, you know, why in all of these places, even places, frankly, where Jews haven't even existed, that anti-Semitism has thrived. But I think it's interesting to go back to sort of that original story.
Well, to your point that America has in some ways been uniquely good for Jews, you write in this book that you worry the Jews of America have lost their instinct for danger. Why is that an important sense to keep sharp?
I think it's important because, like many Jews of my generation, and I would even say of my parents' generation, we were raised on a mythology of America as being the golden of Medina, being the golden land, as, you know, our Ashkenazi grandparents thought about this country. And, you know, there was a lot that was missed in that, a lot that I learned in researching for this book. Unlike many Jews and many Americans of my generation, I'm 35, I'm an elder millennial. I grew up with the name Charles Coughlin being someone that was talked about. Most people of my generation don't know who that is, but that was a Catholic priest who had a radio show that tens of millions, I think 20 million Americans, I'd have to check that number, but millions of Americans listened to his show. The town he was from in Michigan had to build an extra post office just to keep up with the amount of fan letters he received. This is a person who talked about the Jews deserving Kristallnacht, how the Jews are Shylocks and bankers. I mean, he traffics in some of the most vile and ancient, really, anti-Semitic ideas. You know, this is a country where in 1939, 20,000 Americans gathered in Madison Square Garden to raise their arms to hail Hitler, to talk about the Jewish communists and, you know, smash Jewish communism. Those were banners that were hung in Madison Square Garden. So those things had existed, but they were really footnotes in the American Jewish story that I was taught. The American Jewish story I was raised on was that this was a country that was a unique experience in diaspora Jewry. We were never second-class citizens here as we had been in so many other countries, not just European countries, Arab countries too. And in many ways, that story was true. But that story, I think, maybe lulled us into a complacency, lulled us into, you know, a place where, frankly, we've been shocked about what's happened over the past 2 or 3 years under the presidency of Donald Trump. And I think maintaining our instinct for danger is important so that we don't become complacent, and so that not just we know where the threats are coming from, but also so we know ourselves and so we know what we're protecting.
Barry Weiss's new book is How to Fight Anti-Semitism. We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from Texas A&M University, striving to maintain a tradition of cultivating courageous leaders focused on global impact and innovation. Texas A&M University, fearless on every front. More at fearlessfront.com.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with New York Times staff writer and editor Barry Weiss. Her new book is called How to Fight Antisemitism. Barry, you grew up in America as a Jew. What does the state of Israel represent to you?
The state of Israel fundamentally represents, I would say, an earthly miracle. It is the Jewish return to political sovereignty after more than 2,000 years of yearning for that land and yearning to control our own lives and our own destinies. That has nothing to do, in my mind, with the policies of the current Israeli government, of which I myself am very, very critical, and I'm happy to get into that. But fundamentally, I think one thing that gets overlooked in all of the talk about whatever the flaws are of the Netanyahu government and the state of a possible Palestinian state is the fact that the Jewish return to political sovereignty, the fact that I get to be alive for that. If you know anything about Jewish history, it's quite unbelievable. You know, the reality of Jewish history is sort of what we're experiencing right now, not just in America, but all over the world. It's the fact that to live safe Jewish lives, we need to have people and police officers with guns and dogs at the doors of our synagogues, which is now what it is to go to synagogue on a normal Sabbath, but certainly on Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah in Manhattan. This kind of goes back to what we were talking before about the holiday from history, I think, that American Jews like me have gotten to experience, and how what we are living through now is sort of a return to the norm in a way. So Israel represents a safe haven. And, you know, Israel wasn't able to save many of the Jews of Europe. Of course, Israel was sort of largely spearheaded by Ashkenazi Jews, Jews of European descent. What it was able to do was to save Jews who had been living lives as second-class citizens in Arab countries. And I think one thing that often gets overlooked in talking about Israel is that the majority of Jews who live in Israel are Jews of color. They're Jews of North African and Middle Eastern descent. They're Mizrahi Jews. And anyway, there's much to talk about here, but I'll stop for that there for now.
Do you think one has to be a Zionist in order to be a good Jew?
You know, I think that it depends what we mean when we talk about Zionism. Do you have an idea of what you mean when you ask that question, or should I just riff on what I think it means?
I would much rather that you riff on it, because I'm sure that your thinking is much deeper than mine on this question.
Sure. So I think that many people, and especially many progressives, misunderstand what Zionism fundamentally means. You can't read the Old Testament, or what I call the Torah, the Bible, and escape the fact that Zionism, meaning the yearning to return to this particular real estate and the yearning to control Jewish destiny, is you can't cut that out any more than you can cut out the idea of one God or the idea of a covenant. Right now, I think one of the things that is sort of papered over when people say, you know, I'm just an anti-Zionist. It's okay. Like, what does that really mean? To be an anti-Zionist in 1920s Poland, right, when everyone, and especially every Jew, was debating how to solve this problem of systemic oppression against Jews, when, you know, they didn't even know where that would ultimately lead to, the bloodletting of 6 million Jews in Europe. But they were all debating it at the time, and there were lots of groups like the Bundists who were saying, the best way to solve and save Jewish lives and protect Jewish lives is not Zionism. Zionism is a betrayal of who we are. What we really need to do is dig in further to our societies. And I would say that that was a legitimate debate at that moment. History, though, has shown that those ideas were not able to save Jewish lives. The Zionist idea was. And what to be an anti-Zionist today fundamentally means that you don't believe that the largest Jewish community on planet Earth should exist. So to which I say, okay, so what do you suggest that the more than 6 million Jews who currently live between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, what should happen to them? That's what I ask anti-Zionists when they tell me that they're an anti-Zionist, and they usually don't have a very good answer. They either would say, you know, they should go back to where they came from. Okay, well, that's not going to happen. Should they fight it out? Should they, you know, and I would say the most, the answer that most people go to is, you know, there should just be a one-state solution. There should just be a binational state. To which I say, that sounds lovely. And maybe if Israel and the West Bank were located in Kansas and Idaho or whatever, in this country, in our political context, that might work. But you have to be really blind about the history and the current politics of the Middle East to suggest that a binational state would mean anything less than another genocide. All you need to do is look at the fate of other unprotected minorities in the Middle East, the Yazidis, the Kurds, who are, you know, right now, thanks to our president, about to experience the unimaginable. Or look at, frankly, even the Christian experience in the region. A decade from now, there's not going to be Christians in the Middle East anymore, including, frankly, in the West Bank. So anyone that suggests a binational state when they talk about being an anti-Zionist, I think, has a very, very ahistorical understanding of the region.
As you note,
look,
please go ahead.
Yeah, I'll just add one other thing. Look, you can be an anarchist and believe that no nation states have a right to exist and sort of justify your opposition, one's opposition to the existence of the state of Israel in that regard. And that's ideologically consistent. You should say there should be no borders in America or China or Japan or India and Pakistan and Israel. That's, I guess, the only ideologically consistent approach. And yet often I don't really hear those people who claim that that's where they're coming from talking about dissolving the border between India and Pakistan. Somehow it's only this one state, Israel.
Let's go on the phones now to Bob, calling from Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I'm really glad to be able to weigh in on this. First of all, let me say that I'm beyond words to summarize my atrocities of what Jews have been subjected to throughout the course of history. But having said that, I'm going to weigh in on your guest question about what would a Zionist, and I've never identified myself as a Zionist, but I guess in her definition I may well be, what would they do with the Israel state? Well, I think what makes a very common sense observation about what I would do with the Israel state is end the theocracy. Any state government controlled and based on a religion, in my mind, is ill-conceived and is bound to have problems. So end the theocracy and base your... And I understand the author said she has issues with the political positions, and I don't quite know what that means, but to take a position based on religion, that the land belongs to them and therefore deny Palestinians their right to settlements in an area, is as profoundly wrong as the converse of denying Israel the right to live where they have found themselves.
Well, Bob, thanks so much for your call. There's a lot that you might want to respond to in that, Barry.
Yeah, Israel is not a theocracy. It is not like the Islamic Republic of Iran or Egypt. I don't know if Bob knows this. 20% of Israelis are Arab, many of whom are Muslim. They suffer some amount of discrimination, but if you poll them, they talk about how they would much rather live in Israel than in a future Palestinian state. There's a lot to talk about in what Bob just suggested, but Chris, you can feel free to sort of direct me.
Well, he was a little bit hard to hear, frankly. I think he had some questions. I'm not quite sure. He didn't define himself as a Zionist or not a Zionist. I'm wondering if he wanted to know whether it's possible to, and you spoke to this briefly before, but I'd love for you to come back to it, to criticize mm-hmm. actions by the state of Israel without being an anti-Semite.
Absolutely, and I'll prove it to people right now. I believe that the ultra-Orthodox rabbinate, and this might be what Bob was referring to, which has a lot of control over public religious life in Israel, so places like the Western Wall. I believe that it is sort of a betrayal of what Israel's ultimate aim should be. When we think about a Jewish state, could it embody Jewish values? I don't think it embodies Jewish values. For example, when I went to the Western Wall in March, I was spit on by ultra-Orthodox young men, and they called me all kinds of horrible names that I will not repeat
on
the radio. Yes, I'm sorry about that F-bomb before. I forgot we were on public radio. So that's one example. Much bigger, I think it is a betrayal of the memory of the 6 million Jews who were murdered in Europe when the Israeli government makes a short-term realpolitik decision to cozy up to authoritarian leaders like Viktor Orban of Hungary, who promotes bigotry and Holocaust revisionism at home, even if, as he claims, to be pro-Israel. I think that the current government of Israel, before this last election and just generally, has indulged in disgusting, racist, anti-Arab rhetoric and fear-mongering, not unlike this current president with minorities here at home. So I have absolutely no problem criticizing lots of things about Israel and the Israeli government. But that doesn't take away sort of my fundamental point, which is the idea of saying you are an anti-Zionist is like saying this community, this largest Jewish community on planet Earth, should find another place to go. And it's also denying just the Jewish experience of all of history, which is Jewish people, our history has been thousands of years of expulsion and oppression and near elimination. The idea that we don't need protection and we don't need an army is just historical revisionism. So I guess that's what I would say. And I would say just from a sort of 10,000-foot perspective, look at the neighborhood where Israel's located. I'm gay. I'm a feminist. There's only one place in the world where I can walk around in the neighborhood where I can walk around wearing a tank top and holding my girlfriend's hand and feel safe. And that's Israel. So I guess I would challenge people who oppose Israel on, quote, you know, progressive reasons, how they explain their opposition to the one place in the Middle East where you can actually be safe as a feminist, a gay person, transgender person, a religious minority, and all the rest.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. What do you make of President Trump's friendly overtures toward Israel, most notably recognizing Jerusalem rather than Tel Aviv as its capital?
I supported that move, which, you know, Congress had supported for years. So he was just enacting something that should have been enacted on years before. I also supported the Trump administration's decision to recognize the Golan Heights as being part of Israel. It has been that practically for a long time. And the idea that that critical piece of real estate would fall back into the hands of a genocidaire like Bashar Assad, I think, is a good thing. So there are lots of, you know, Trump administration policies regarding Israel and just in general, you know, for example, the sanctions that they just named against various companies that do business in China. I supported that too. But fundamentally, and I've said this many times before, but I'll say it again, I think that the Trump administration and the president specifically have made the world and this country so much less safe for Jews, and that any policy is not worth that price. Meaning policies, as we know, can be done or undone. We saw it with the Iran deal. We see it with Obamacare, with any number of things. What can't be undone, what this president is doing, is renting apart the fabric of our culture, which is, as I think we've learned, and not just the Jews, but any minority, is so, so fragile and delicate. And once that is ripped apart, that is just not something that can be made whole easily. And I'm frankly really terrified by what he has done and what he has done sort of happily and gleefully in turning Americans against one another.
Why do you think anti-Semites were drawn as voters to President Trump?
Because I think Trump played on the major chords that anti-Semites are drawn from, in that anti-Semitism is kind of, it's the ultimate conspiracy theory. And Trump himself is a conspiracy theorist. And I don't just mean that in the sense of retweeting conspiracy theorists and conspiracy theory accounts, although of course he does that too. It's that he looks at the world and says, and looks at this country, and he said to voters, there's a secret hand, not there's a secret hand controlling the world. He didn't quite say that. What he said is, I know who's keeping you down. It's the elitists. It's the globalists. It's the bankers. It's all of these nefarious forces that you can't control. And what anti-Semites like Richard Spencer heard in that was, I know who that person is, and it's the Jew. So I think that it's not a coincidence that people like that were drawn to Trump's banner. And, you know, since he's become president, there's all kinds of tropes that he's engaged in when it comes to the idea of Jews not being loyal if they don't support Republicans. I think one of the most egregious things he did is when he attacked the squad, and he attacked the squad, in the squad meaning the clatch of progressive, democratic new members of Congress like AOC, Ilhan Omar, and Rashida Tlaib, and I think Ayanna Pressley was the fourth one who he attacked. And he said to them, they're not really American. And what he specifically said was they need to go back to the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came. And as a Jew who knows about the way that that trope, the trope of provisional belonging and dual loyalty, has been used against us, I shuddered, because the idea that they are not fully American is something that has been used against us, against the Jews, in so many other times and places. And that kind of idea is just absolutely, is just so, so dangerous.
Barry Weiss is my guest. She's a staff writer and editor in the opinion section at the New York Times and author of a new book called How to Fight Anti-Semitism. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with New York Times staff writer and opinion section editor Barry Weiss. Her book is called How to Fight Anti-Semitism. Barry, you say anti-Semitism on the far political right and the far political left seem different, but are mirror images of the same goal, which in your words is to eliminate the Jew. Can you talk about the evidence that you see of this? I think on the right, you might be talking about violent attacks. What evidence do you see of it on the left?
Well, as I said before, white supremacist violence and aims are announced bluntly and achieved bluntly. What you see on the left is something like what you saw in the Soviet Union. And I don't want to compare it. I mean, it's obviously, at least in this country, nowhere near what's happening somewhere like England at the moment. But what we're seeing is a kind of anti-Semitism becoming politically survivable. The way that it functions on the left, and I want to just get historical for a moment because I think it'll be useful, is that anti-Semitism on the far left doesn't demand dead Jews. What it demands is that Jews themselves flush whatever parts of Jewish life or religious practice or civilization or culture are an anathema to the regime. So in the Soviet, Spanish Inquisition, what that looked like is you got to convert to Catholicism to survive. In the Soviet Union, where religious faith and religious practice was unacceptable to the Communist Party, Jews had to disavow their religiosity, even though they could survive as Jews, just not actually as Jews. And today, I think what it looks like on the far left increasingly is that power right now is the thing that is unacceptable and profane, certainly on the activist left, but increasingly moving into the mainstream. And in order to sort of be accepted as a progressive and a Jew, what is asked of the Jew is that the person disavows any connection with Jewish power. And the most obvious totem of that power, of course, is the Jewish state. And so I think that there's actually a tremendous amount of pressure for Jews to disavow Israel's existence and to sort of convert into anti-Zionism in order to be acceptable in progressive coalitions. And you see examples of this everywhere. I think the most stark one that comes to mind, but I hear from college students every day where this is normative now, is after Charlottesville, after the Unite the Right march, right, in which white supremacists walked through campus with tiki torches saying Jews will not replace us, there was a minority student coalition to fight white supremacy that formed at the University of Virginia. And Jews were barred from that coalition to fight white supremacy because the idea was that Jews were not victim enough, because Jews were actually handmaidens of white supremacy because Jews support the state of Israel.
All right, I want to go to the phones. Let's speak with Ritu in Dallas, Texas. Hi.
Hi. This is wonderful. I'm so excited to hear this discussion. And Ms. Weiss is actually, I'm not of Jewish descent. I'm of Hindu descent. But my parents fled Pakistan in the late 1940s because, you know, there was no rights. And when Ms. Weiss talked about the ground realities of how Israel has survived, and where it, you know, where the Palestinian and the Israeli states have to be separated, at least for now, you know, it is a reality for all minorities in that area, and not just the Middle East, but any Islamic, you know, regime. So I really appreciate the fact that this is on air for all those people, not just the Jewish in Israel and the Jewish all over the world, but even others who have very similar experiences, have had very similar experiences in the history. And, of course, to change this whole mentality of anti-Semitism. Thank you. I'm so excited to hear this, and I would like to pass this on to my family because we feel as if we're so underrepresented.
Thanks for calling. Did you want to respond to anything there, Barry?
I'm just really grateful for that caller. And, you know, I think one of the things that's just... We haven't really talked about anti-Semitism in the Muslim world on this interview, and frankly, I don't get asked about it a lot. And I think one of the reasons is that it's so enormous of a problem. It's so fundamental. Like, it's in the water in so many of these countries. And I find it just extremely overwhelming when I try and confront it and to be honest, when I set out to write this book, I had almost hoped to avoid a chapter on it because one of the things that's so hard, especially in an American context, right, one of the reasons that it's so hard to criticize someone like Ilhan Omar when she says anti-Semitic things is that she herself is the subject of discrimination and bigotry and targeting, not least by the president of the United States. And so it's really hard here in America, where we know that Muslims and women of color are the targets of bigots themselves, to call out bigotry that they express, because who would want to contribute to sort of further xenophobia? Who would want to contribute to further racism or anti-Islamic bigotry against them? And so one thing I write about in the book is that I think it's really important to criticize people based on their ideas and not based on their identities. We have a president who attacks people based on immutable characteristics and not based on their ideas. And I think it's really important for us to sort of do the opposite of what he does in that regard. But I think one of the reasons that there's much less discussion about anti-Semitism when it comes from someone like Ilhan Omar, like she'll be invited on Face the Nation, and Steve King, who is a racist and anti-Semite, won't, is because of her identity. And it just makes it much harder to confront, I think.
We have an email here from Jared who says, it's common on the right to say it's anti-Semitic to not support the government of Israel in its treatment of Palestinians. I personally don't see that that is any more anti-Semitic than it is Islamophobic to criticize the Saudi government's treatment of its own citizens or the Yemeni people. And Jared would like your perspective on that.
Wait, I'm not sure I follow that. Jared, I don't think it's Islamophobic to criticize the Saudi government, and I don't think it's anti-Semitic to criticize the Israeli government. I think that's fair game.
All right. Well, there we go.
Am I answering? I mean, I want to make sure I understood him.
Well, that was his. He said it's common to say that it's anti-Semitic to not support the government of Israel in its treatment of Palestinians. He doesn't see that as any more anti-Semitic than it is Islamophobic to criticize the Saudi government's treatment of the Yemeni people. So I think
I'm tracking that, and I think I agree with him. Yes.
All right. What do you say to fellow Jews who just don't see it as an important part of their identity or their Jewishness to deeply identify with the state of Israel?
I think that there have always been, in all of Jewish history, a tremendous multiplicity of views inside the Jewish community. I mean, there's a reason that the oldest joke about the Jews is two Jews, three opinions. that's who we are. We are an arguing people. The word Israel literally means to wrestle with God. That is what it means. So we are an arguing people. I think we have good reason to be very, very proud of that legacy. I also think that amazing things have been sustained in exile in the Jewish diaspora. The Talmud was written in the Babylonian exile. I mean, I could go down the line. It's the prerogative of any Jew to think whatever he or she wants. I'm not going to stand in judgment of that. All I would say is that to imagine that there was a diaspora experience where Jews were both powerless and protected and safe is simply ahistorical. That's what I would suggest to them. And if you care about protecting Jewish lives, that leads you to certain conclusions.
One of the things that you recommend to Jews is to lean into their Jewishness in this moment. What does that mean exactly?
What I mean is that anyone who's ever been bullied, and certainly any minority, knows that when you get punched, figuratively or literally, there is a very human part of you that just wants to disappear or just wants to cut off that part of you or hide that part of you that is attacked. I think it's just a very, very human response. But I think that, A, that's not the way that the Jewish people have sustained our civilization for this long against all odds. But it also is a tragedy if that is the response to this moment. I think, you know, if anything good can come from this sort of ongoing punch to the gut that we've been experiencing for the past while, and it seems like it's speeding up, at least for many of us, is to try and figure out what it is we're fighting for. You know, the book is called How to Fight Anti-Semitism, but we don't just need to fight anti-Semites so we can survive as Jewish bodies. That's meaningless. That's to live as a zombie, frankly. We want to fight anti-Semites because there's something worth fighting for. There's something worth protecting. And I think if anything, doing this book and going to visit Jewish communities all over the country and hopefully soon all over the world has given me a sense of what those things are that we're fighting to protect. So that's what I mean when I say leaning into Judaism. And I think that there are just amazing models of that. The fact that after he was shot in Poway, on April 27th, 2018, the rabbi there, two of his fingers were shot. He would go on to lose one of them. And before he went to the hospital, he insisted on sort of finishing his sermon to his community. That to me is just an amazing, amazing testimony. And I would say that the other thing that has just really moved me is the solidarity that we've seen. Certainly in the Pittsburgh community at large after the attack, the fact that Muslim leaders and Christian leaders stood and by our side, and the fact that the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, which is, you know, the paper of record in Pittsburgh, printed in Hebrew script the words of the mourner's Kaddish, the mourner's prayer on the front page of the paper, that to me is a departure from all of Jewish history that really cannot be understated. You know, at first glance, what happened in Pittsburgh was another pogrom in the long history of pogroms that the Jewish people has suffered. But what was different about it and what gives me so much hope for this country is that the visceral response of the surrounding community wasn't to turn their backs to us. It was to stand next to us. And you're seeing that really among any leaders and any community that understand that communities that can't protect their Jews are societies that are dead or already are dying. One incredible example of that is Sadiq Khan, the Muslim mayor of London, who went to the Jewish Labor Party conference a few weeks ago, and when he was berated outside by people saying, why are you going to meet with these Jews, you know, anti-Semites within his own party, he said, I'm going to show solidarity with my Jewish brothers and sisters because I'm as interested in them as fighting against anti-Semitism in my own party. That is solidarity and that is leadership. And I think that those are the kind of bright spots that we really want to be elevating in this moment as examples to everyone else.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I also want to talk to you about this recommendation. You say don't trust people who seek to divide Jews, even if they are Jews. What are you referring to there?
I'm referring to the very, very long history of Jews who often put the target on the backs of their co-religionists in order to protect themselves. That sounds harsh, and I don't mean it to be harsh. I think it comes from a very long history of using that strategy, and it's a strategy born out of trauma. When there are Jews who say, the people that are really putting us in danger are the Zionists, or the people that are really putting us in danger is the Netanyahu government, or the people that are really putting us in danger are the ultra-Orthodox Jews in Brooklyn who insist on walking around in their 18th century garb. To all of that, I say it's BS, because nothing justifies anti-Semitism. Nothing. And I think that we should be wary of anyone who suggests that it's our fault that people hate us. And unfortunately, we see a lot of that sort of finger pointing, including inside our own divided community.
Are you more afraid now than you once were as a Jew?
Yes. I still believe that, and the reason I wrote this book is that I think that America is exceptional in so many ways. And I think that the cancer that we're seeing here is at stage one and not at stage three or four as it is in various places in Europe. But I'd be lying if I didn't tell you that it is scary to me when I walk into a synagogue now and there are dogs and metal detectors and police with guns. I just couldn't have imagined that when I was growing up. And, you know, early on when I was writing this book, I told people, like, one of the things that's so important is we need to be showing our Judaism publicly by wearing a Jewish star or wearing a kippah in public, and I still feel that way. But then when I see that Jews who are doing that in places like Brooklyn are getting beaten in the streets, I hesitate a little more.
Barry Weiss's new book is How to Fight Anti-Semitism. Barry, thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you so much, Chris.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We hope that you will subscribe to the podcast. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.